James Randolino started a hedge fund, which was a fraud, a Ponzi scheme, all the illegal activity, how he went from civil to criminal. We really dive in to the details of his fraud, the psychology of it. Like, what's critical is that not all frauds have the same flavor. All frauds are bad. Don't get me wrong. It is morally bad to do a fraud. There's a reason why he went to jail. He wanted to go to jail. He tried to kill himself, and it's amazing the story of how he failed to do that. But before I give too much away, we're going to discuss in detail the fraud. And then tomorrow I'm going to release the story of him going to jail, what happened there, and how he came out the other side. Let's dive into the details of the fraud that James Brandolino committed.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show.
James, thanks so much for coming on the show. And you're going to describe your story in a moment. But when I was reading your story, so I was running a hedge fund that I had started from scratch around the same time as you were.
Yes.
I could totally understand what was going through your mind and why you did what you did. And of course, the eventual outcome. But maybe in your words, describe what happened. And again, I appreciate you coming on the show. It's very interesting, and it's a very interesting lesson about the psychology of fraud.
Yeah, the psychology of fraud, James, and really how fast things happen. You know, most investment fraud does not start out as investment fraud. I think that's probably where I want to start first. You know, most people don't wake up one morning working at Amazon and say, you know, I want to steal $5, $10, $15, $20, $50 million, right? And they go out, they get a website, and they get some legal and marketing documents. They open up a bank account and start soliciting for investor funds. And then, you know, when the feds or the SEC knocks on the door, or they get the phone call, you know, they're on the jet going to Brazil to hide with the money. That rarely happens that way. And in my case, you know, I had been trading for a long time. I have a background that's very heavy in the futures and securities market. I worked on the trading floor in college, on the grain floor and in foreign exchange. So I knew the floor very well. I was an ops manager and a trading desk manager at a firm that is now defunct, but a former global leader, MF Global, based out of New York. I worked in the Chicago office.
When you say you're the trading manager, what does that mean? Are you trading, or is that the back office, or what is that?
No, I was actually, so when I was an ops manager, I was a junior ops manager over probably 40, 50 employees who were on the trading desk. But when I was a desk manager, there was another person and myself who were running our own book of business.
Okay. So you knew what you were doing. You knew how to trade.
I've been trading since I was in high school. And just to do a quick backstory, my whole motivation to trade came when, you know, after my freshman year in high school in 83, when the movie Trading Places came out, right? And Dan Aykroyd and Eddie Murphy are trying to corner the frozen concentrated orange juice market at the New York Board of Trade. And that's really kind of where my impetus to start trading and have a career in trading began. And, you know, when I was at MF Global, I had designed an intermediate term bond trading strategy, trading basically the yield curve, 10 versus, you know, 30 year treasury bond futures. And
so what does that mean? So the US government, and just from very basics, the US government issues bonds, which are essentially they're borrowing money from other people. And some are 3-year bonds, and some are 5-year bonds, and some are 10-year bonds. And I guess they always trade kind of a certain distance from each other, and you if that distance went out of whack, you would arbitrage it somehow. You would like buy one and sell the other.
Right, exactly. Right, trading the tens versus the thirties. You know that's the yield curve, the spread. You know, changes every day, although it's not quite as volatile as trading the outright instruments. But there are certain patterns that, you know, I thought I'd recognized, and you know, we traded that really for, you know, for 3 years before I decided to go out on my own.
And how were you doing when you were trading for MF Global? Were you generally up?
So when I was in UF Global, I was very limited in terms of approaching clients with our trading system. It was more of a discount, a kind of a Charles Schwab operation in terms of the clients that we had. It was a lot of funds that we had, and basically they're calling their own shots. We're just basically placing orders and developing business that way. So I left MF Global in 99 and formed my own small futures brokerage firm so I could solicit clients and trade this system with the ultimate goal of eventually going out on my own. And, you know, I was shooting probably 5.5% to about 6.5%. And, you know, drawdowns were pretty low. And, you know, after about 3.5 years of having that track record under my belt, I decided to become a member of the board of trade and start a futures hedge fund. And hey, that's what I did.
Can I ask a question?
Absolutely.
I'm sorry to always interrupt, but
no.
If I don't ask now, I'll never ask.
Absolutely.
So 5.5%, 6% in 1999, everybody I knew then was quitting their hedge funds and their brokers because, you know, they didn't understand that 5.5%, 6% was a great return if you had no drawdowns. Like, it was a good, solid return. But, you know, this was the internet boom. Everyone wanted 200%.
Correct. So, and basically, you know, my clients were mostly high net worth individuals, business owners, and this was just a small piece, kind of an alternative investment for, you know, for their portfolio. So, you know, I wasn't, you know, managing, you know, 50% of somebody's portfolio with this strategy. It was, you know, maybe, you know, 5%, 8%, no more than 10% as an alternative strategy.
How would they justify investing with you when they see all their friends making, like, you know, oh, just buy any internet stock and you're going to make that in a day? Like, you're making 5.5% a year plus your, you know, a hedge fund. So it's a little more risk because it's, you don't have access to the money, or the investor doesn't. Like, how would you sell such a strategy?
It's a small piece of their portfolio. And a lot of these guys were making, you know, were swing for the fence kind of guys, right? So they were doing really well in other parts. It's just a small piece. And it definitely was a part of the sales process. I mean, everybody that, you know, most of my initial investors were family, friends of family, people that I knew a long time, and of course my longstanding brokerage clients. So I had already a relationship with everyone that I solicited to invest in my fund, right?
How much were you able to raise in this period?
We raised $2 million initially.
So it was like a good start. You wanted to build up, prove a track record, and then go for the gold. Raise, like, at that time, a large fund would be like $100 million.
Correct. But I mean, even at that point, you know, if I could have raised, you know, $10 million, I mean, I understand I didn't come from a bank. I didn't come from, you know, JP Morgan or, you know, Morgan Stanley or any of the big banks. I was, you know, just someone who, you know, kind of came up from the bootstraps and, you know, learned on my own and didn't really have a lot of contacts at the time, and basically just raised money where I could, which was former clients and family and friends.
So, and again, I'm sorry for asking so many questions, but like, with a few million, and you're charging like a 2 and 20, like 2% of assets, 20% of profits, something
Correct.
Like that?
Correct.
Were you able to make a living at that point, or you had money saved?
Well, we're not even going to get to that. So I had quite a bit of money saved, but I think we need to take a step back and really kind of talk about the catalyst for how the fraud started.
Okay.
So, which is really interesting, because the catalyst was, I became a member of the board of trade. All of my documents were done, and I'm waiting literally on the floor. And I had 3 or 4 jobs on the floor. I knew people. I knew how it operated. So it's not like I was new to the floor. I'm waiting for the board of trade IT department to come and hook all of my equipment up at the desk. And I'm just kind of walking around, and there's the Dow Jones futures pit, right? And I'm just mesmerized about, you know, these huge orders coming in, huge paper coming in that just moving the Dow, you know, 50, 80 points in a matter of a minute or 2 or 3 minutes. And I'm just kind of thinking to myself, boy, wouldn't it be interesting if I could rework my models a little bit and to account for this volatility and maybe earn another 100, 200, 300 basis points, and I could be at that 8%, 8.5%, 9%, and I'd be a hero. Now, understand, you know, none of my clients had ever suggested, boy, you know, we wish that you were, you know, making more money, or we wish that you were, you know, trying to, you know, be a little bit more aggressive in your trading. They were all happy with, you know, the little piece that I was managing in their portfolio. And kind of just like that, I took about a week before I started even trading for the fund, and I reworked some models, and I did some real quick back testing, and it back tested. Okay. I mean, nothing great, but I'll make it work, right? I've traded for a long time. So my first week of trading, I lost 3%.
Ugh, and that just feels so bad, particularly you're just starting. These are your friends and family. They see all their friends making 100% a year and boom.
Yeah. And, you know, it's not so much 3% because I had a few months where I was down over 3% when I was managing their funds as a broker. But, you know, like you just said, it's month number one, right, of the new fund. And I had a couple of weeks because I had it scheduled that a independent CPA firm would get all the documents from the brokerage firm and they would run all the numbers and they would send statements to clients. And I'm just kind of thinking, what am I going to do? I've got 2 weeks before this is going to happen. I've got to get everybody on the phone or go visit everybody. Or I've got to do something, right? And just to show you how fast it happens, I'm sitting in an office in the Board of Trade with one of my colleagues. You know, he's on the phone. I'm paging through in, you know, Institutional Investor magazine. And the light bulb goes off. James, I see an advertisement for hedge fund accounting software. And just like that, I'm like, here's the answer. All I've got to do is buy the software, put all the information in there, show a small gain instead of a loss. I mean, you know, 3% is actually 2.89%, right? I could make this back. I've been trading for a long time. I could make it back in a month, 2 months tops. And we'll, you know, at that point, you know, after 2-3 months, whatever it would be to make it back, you know, I can hire the old CPA firm again and everything will be fine.
Right. So this is like step number one, like, okay, in numeric terms, like if you had a $2 million fund, you're down 2.89%, you're down, I don't know, $57,000, which it feels like you could make that up and it doesn't feel like you're robbing anybody of $5 million or anything like that. It just feels like something you could get to and then it's all good and nobody loses money and you're a hero again.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that was the motivation to do it. And it was, you know, that, not that I wanted to let everyone down. That's definitely part of it. The other part, I'm thinking, well, if I show a 3% loss, I mean, you know, what are these guys going to think? It's your first month. I mean, you know, we trusted you and, you know, are they going to pull out? And, you know, if so many people pull out, I'm going to have to close the fund. And then what am I going to do? Right. So yeah, it was that kind of situation.
Because, and again, I'm diving into like what you were thinking. You thought like, then what am I going to do? Because A, it feels good to be on your own. It doesn't feel good to then go back to the job admitting failure. But B, how are you going to get a job as a trader, which is what you were doing when, or this is what could be going through your mind. How are you going to get a job as a trader when you just lost this money trading? So
right,
it's not only feels bad, it's like you really were calling your existence into question.
Exactly right. And just to make another point with what you said, not that I lost money trading. I lost money trading a system that was not my system. You know, I had never really studied that. Although I took orders for, you know, clients who traded indices, you know, when I was a broker. But in terms of studying that volatility in that market and those players and what moves that market, et cetera, and the psychology, it was just something that was kind of foreign to me. So it's the worst part about it was that I wasn't even trading my strategy. I was actually trading a market that I was not familiar with, which was a recipe for disaster, of course.
Well, you were trading the stock market instead of the bond market.
Correct.
And what month are we talking about?
Yeah, so this is beginning of February of 2003.
February of 2003. So I was trading pretty actively then. And at that time, the best strategy, not so much on Dow futures, but on NASDAQ futures or NASDAQ 100 futures, was basically if something dipped, you'd buy it and it would go up. So I don't know if you were counter trend trading or what you were doing.
I was trading a mean reversion strategy.
Yeah, so mean reversion strategies did work. But February 2003, you know, we were kind of preparing for war at that time, which started a month later. And things were pretty volatile. You had to have some guts at that. In February and March was a little more volatile. Those were probably the most volatile months of 2003, if I remember correctly.
Correct. So what's interesting is that in terms of trading a mean reversion strategy, yeah, buying the dips is great. But when you're, you know, when you're trying to sell the upper channel, you know, going back to the mean, you know, that's where I would get crushed. So, you know, I would have maybe 3, 4, 5 winning trades, small winners, and then I get crushed on that, you know, trying to sell the upper channel and to go back, and that's when I would just get hit. It would just take one or two trades to wipe everything out plus. So on that, on average, for every you know, 2% winner, there was a, you know, a 3% loser, 4%.
That's the thing about mean reversion strategies, is that you're going to have lots of winners. In a single month of 20 trading days, you might have 19 winners and one loser, and you still lose money.
And you're exactly right. And it's really, really, really tough. And I understand too, when I was trading for my bond strategy, I was probably, you know, doing a couple trades at most a week, probably three trades every 2 weeks. When I was, you know, trading, you know, the S&Ps and the Dow futures, you know, I was trading probably 5, 6, 7, 8 times a day. So in terms of the psychology involved, and I'm sure you can attest to this, the psychology involved in that kind of trading is completely different than something that's intermediate term or long-term trading.
Yeah, very much so. You're living and dying. I would feel my whole blood course through my body, every heartbeat, like every tick would affect my psychology.
I mean, it's awful. You know, it's like sports. It's like, you know, you got two pieces in terms of trading. You've got the quantitative models that are telling you what you should be doing, and then you've got the psychology part. Should I actually do it, or can I follow that model, right? And if I have 5 losers in a row, how can I take that next trade? Or if I have 5 winners in a row, can I take that next trade, right? And it's, you know, and that's the worst part. You know, you have 3, 4 big losing trades, and the next trade you don't take, and that's the one that's going to get you to about even, or maybe a little bit above even. So it's, you know, psychology is so important in trading, as you know. There's 3 stages of my fraud. This first stage lasted about a year and a half. So after about a year and a half, I've probably got about $50,000 in the hedge fund. And I'm thinking, well, what am I going to do? I'm a sales introvert. I didn't want to go back to everybody and say, I need to raise more money, right? Let's put more money in. Let's make this thing bigger. So what do? I raid my 401k account. I get a home equity line of credit on my condo. I basically put my entire net worth into the fund to try to make it work, right?
Now, and at this point, when you said you had $50,000 in the fund, you were like roughly $2 million down to $50,000, like you had lost everything?
Correct.
And that's because, were you taking bigger and bigger swings? Like, were your position sizes going up?
They weren't huge positions, but they were large enough to, you know, to in a year and a half, you know, lose about $2 million.
And at this point, it's very important to realize the problem here was not that you were down money. The problem here is that your investors didn't know you were down. If you had never said anything to your investors, nothing illegal never would have happened at this point, but you were telling investors that they were actually up.
They think they're making, you know, 1%, you know, 1.25% per month, and actually they're down, at the end of the year and a half, about 100%. Correct.
Yeah. So they thought maybe there was like 2.1 million in the fund, but in reality there was $50,000 in the fund.
Exactly. So after that year and a half, I began putting my own money into the fund, which of course is against SEC rules, because I didn't let everyone, my investors, know that I was flooding the fund with my personal money, because basically I'm trying to, you know, cover the losses, right? So that was really stage two, and that lasted for about a year, right?
What was illegal there? Well, why is that against SEC rules? Because if you had disclosed to your investors, listen, I'm down, but I'm going to pay you back with my personal money, here it is, that wouldn't have been illegal.
No, it would have been fraud. It would have been civil. I probably would have been kicked off the board of trade. It would have been censured by the SEC. But at that point, it was civil because I had not taken any money, right? They were just losses that were legitimate losses that I was hiding.
Right. And again, if you had been disclosing losses, it wouldn't have been any problem at all.
So yes and no. So, you know, fund managers lose money all the time. And as long as they lose it legally, technically, I didn't lose it legally because I was not trading my bond system. Now, if I had lost the money trading my bond system, then and I had all the risks disclosed in my hedge fund documents, absolutely, there'd have been no issue.
people are going to hate me for interrupting all the time, but I just want to make, you know, people always say, oh, you're let them talk. But I just really want to understand. So the hedge fund docs said specifically what your strategy was, and you didn't leave room for, on occasion, the hedge fund manager might trade other strategies.
Correct.
Okay. So now I understand why, at the very least, you were in trouble with the SEC, if not breaking the law.
Correct. But at that point, it's just civil. So, you know, I dumped my personal net worth in the fund, and this lasts about another year, just over a year. So now we're almost at the 3-year mark, right? And, you know, I'm basically back down to that, you know, $50,000 to $100,000 in the fund. And I'm like, man, what am I going to do? I've got no money. I'm broke. I'm going to have to sit down with everybody. I'm not sure what's going to happen here, right?
Were you married?
I was actually divorced. I actually got divorced in 2004.
And was it because of the stress related to what was going on?
Well, that was definitely part of it. My ex-wife was not from the, although she was a U.S. citizen, she was not from the United States. And I just really, really felt I didn't want to get her involved in the whole mess. And basically, I just, you know, decided that, you know, we should get divorced. And yeah, I basically told her I didn't want to have kids. And that was like a, you know, being, you know, European, that was real important to her. And I just didn't want to get her involved because she had absolutely nothing to do with the whole situation. Because she was also a registered rep in the futures industry with another firm. So I didn't want to get her involved at all.
So, but at this point, this is where you're neck deep in your isolation. Like you thought initially, okay, it's fraud, but I'm going to make this up quickly and no one will know. Well, I'll wash my hands of it, and it's going to be good in the long run. But now you realize you're in trouble, and this is midway through, and you're probably stressed out of your mind. Was your libido functioning? You were probably too stressed to fool around with your wife.
Well, you know, that's a good question. I really don't really remember all that much. You know, I at that point, I really wasn't dating. I was pretty much focused on turning this thing around. And you know, I had a lot of clients who were local. And, you know, most of my clients were high net worth individuals. And, you know, I had a few that would call me probably at least once a week. How are we doing? What's going on? Hey, the bond market did this. How do we do? The bond market did that. How are we going to do this month? And, you know, I would get calls. Hey, we want to come down and see ya. Because, I was kind of like the anti-Madoff. I was not secretive at all. People wanted to come down to the floor and watch me trade. Because I traded every day. It's not like I never traded, right, and took the money and ran. I was trading literally every day. And if people wanted to come down and watch me trade and look at my screens and stand next to me on the floor at my desk space, they were more than welcome to do it. So I was always very open about and transparent about, you know, about what I was trading and how I was trading. And I would get calls all the time, from my clients, you know, asking questions. Where the key comes in is at that almost the 3-year mark. And I'm just kind of saying, what am I going to do? I've got it, you know, I got to get everybody in a room and just kind of say, hey, this is what happened. I haven't taken any money. We lost the money legitimately, but you know, we got to do something here, right? And out of the middle of nowhere, I get a phone call and almost didn't take the call. It was a referral from one of my really good clients who wanted to come into the fund. And my buy-in at the time was only $50,000. And he goes, well, I want to put more in the fund. Is that okay? I go, well, sure. What are you thinking? He goes, I want to put 500 in. I'm thinking 500. Oh my God, here we go. Now I can, if I take this money, I can not only bring in some quant analysts, I can try to fix this thing and I can have some money to live on. And really from that 3-year mark through year 8, that's when I was actually taking money from the fund to provide for living and business expenses.
I see. So this is a big transition. So it's important to understand. So now with this 500,000, you weren't just going to say to yourself, okay, this is money I can now invest to make back everything. It's now this is money I can use to live and improve my trading while I simply figure this out, like how I'm going to survive. So this is going to just sort of like bridge the way until you figure out a solution, but you were going to actually use this money to live on, which is definitely criminal.
Absolutely. And that's really where the lexicon changed things from civil to criminal. And I probably didn't know it in those terms at the time, but you know, I knew that it was absolutely wrong for me to actually take that money. But really there was never, during the whole period, there was never, you know, more than a, you know, a couple of days in a row where I really didn't think I could make the money back.
But let me ask you a question.
And there were so many ways that, you know, that I tried to make it back and just couldn't. And one of the ways was I was doing a lot of trading in my personal account, in my individual account, because as a member of the exchange, I could trade just huge, huge numbers in my individual account. And as long as I was flat at the end of the day, I mean, I could trade 100 to 1 margin, if not more. You know, wow. With $100,000, I could trade $10-15 million worth of S&P or Dow or NASDAQ futures. And as long as I was flat, by day's end, there'd be no problem.
So this is where you did start taking big swings to try to make everything back.
Bigger swings, yeah. And I wouldn't say I swung for the fence every day. I mean, did I have days where I was down 50, 60 grand? And yeah, but I also had days where I was up, 30, 40, 50 grand too. So, but of course, the losing days definitely outnumbered the winning gains. I mean, usually my losses were on average probably $10,000, $15,000 per trade, and my winners were averaging probably $3,000, $4,000 per trade. So I did swing through the fences on some occasions, but it wasn't, thankfully, I guess, every day.
I mean, so the $500,000 you were using. Okay, well, let me back up a second. So,
sure.
The fact that you consider taking in this $500,000 in order to have some money to live on shows that you are thinking now, okay, I'm entering into the world of criminal fraud. So my gut tells me you probably were stressed, but not as stressed as you could have been. Like, you actually felt some relief that this $500,000 could come in because now you could live. And you had good intentions in a weird way, in that you wanted to solve a problem, but your brain was now acknowledging that you were willing to do this.
Yeah, I mean, the pain of escalating the fraud from civil to criminal was much less painful than having to make those phone calls or sit down with everybody in a room and say, this is what I did. This is what happened. I lied. And you're basically, your money's gone because I lost the trading.
Two small questions. One is, were any of your investors, was this like money that was life or death to them?
No, 95% of my clients were sophisticated, high net worth. There were no grandmothers or grandfathers who lost their homes.
And during this time before, when you were considering making all the phone calls, did you consider killing yourself?
We can talk about it at the end.
Okay.
I mean, before we get to that part, I would say, I was never going to let myself get caught. If I ever saw the FBI come on the floor, or if I ever got a call from, the SEC Commodity Futures Trading Commission that they wanted to look at my books and records, I was never, ever, ever going to let that happen. I was always going to commit suicide before that happened. But I know at the end of the story, there's definitely a climax to that. Yes.
And then just in terms of trading strategy, again, I am very familiar with those years, even day by day. Like, I remember the trading so viscerally. And I was doing a mean reversion strategy similar to you, sometimes on S&P futures, never on Dow futures, but always on NASDAQ 100 futures. It did work pretty well. Although I will say, like, that, again, that type of strategy, you get lots of wins. It's high probability wins, but the losses are very painful. And managing those losses is the key to a strategy like that. And it's very quant-based. You have to know when the mean reversion is going to kick in statistically. Like, historically speaking, when do NASDAQ futures mean reversion usually kick in? That's what I would trade off of.
Yeah, and even if I would put some type of filter in there, just trading from the long side or do something, having a long-term indicator that, if this was in a long trend, I'm only going to take trades from the long side, or on the short side, maybe cut my size in half or down a quarter and trade less size from the short side when the trend is up. But I just didn't do it.
But also because you had a different agenda, in that you were also not only trying to run a fund, but trying to get out of the hole of civil fraud. I mean, yes. No matter what, you had committed civil fraud.
Absolutely.
But you could have. A lot of people out there are not caught because they fall into situations like you, and then they climb out of the hole. Now, unfortunately, you were not able to climb out of the hole. And before you continue the story, I'm always curious, do you think Madoff started the way you started? Like, he was considered a genius, right? He was the first head of the NASDAQ. He was considered this genius prodigy guy. And then he started a fund. Do you think his first month he was down 3% and then just bit by bit became the largest fraud in history?
Absolutely. And it's chronicled by Diana Enriquez, the New York Times reporter who wrote a book, and it's on my shelf here if I can see it, and I don't see it. She wrote a book about Madoff. And in the early 60s, he was trading just penny stocks and basically lost a ton of money during this major downturn because he was basically telling his clients, his investors, that, you know, that it was safe and secure, and he basically lost it all. He actually borrowed, and I'm thinking this is circa maybe 61, 62, 63, and he actually went to his father-in-law and borrowed the equivalent of, I want to say, like $400,000 in today's money, and paid back all of his investors so they would not know that he lost their money. And he actually paid back his father-in-law as well. But that just goes to show you on the psychology of just the fear of letting others see, you know, your shortcomings, especially in trading, and that maybe you're not as smart as you thought you were, et cetera.
Right, because trading is so much, like, everyone's just calling you a genius, like, particularly a guy like Madoff, like, everyone's calling him a genius. And then if he loses money, it's like his images of himself changes.
Yeah, well, and what's really interesting is, you know, I mean, with Madoff is that, I mean, he was a legitimate business person. I mean, you know, being with the sixth largest market maker, and I think it was in 07. So, what, you know, what he did with, in terms of electronic trading and saving investors money, you know, getting fills back, you know, within, you know, 3 to 5 seconds versus, you know, what was it before, 30 seconds a minute? I mean, he was just huge in that realm. So he actually had a lot of street cred that was well deserved. But he just took that trust and wrapped it into his money management scheme.
And the fact that he did this once before, like in the 60s, and sort of covered up the problem successfully, probably made him think he could do it again in the early 90s or whenever his fraud started, and he just wasn't able to. So I always wondered whether it was he had bad intentions from the beginning, or it just started with fear and perhaps good intentions, but I always wonder if he just slipped into the criminal stuff. Since your clients thought you were up each year, and this is your fourth year, were you taking fees on your quote-unquote wins that didn't exist?
No, big red flag. I never took fees from my clients.
And were they suspicious that you weren't taking fees? Were they telling you, hey,
no, James, I don't need the money. Don't worry about it. I've got you know, plenty of clients. I'm, you know, you guys have started with me from the beginning. I don't need to take fees.
Got it. So you avoided for a long time, you avoided criminal implications. But now the decision point was, do I call everyone and completely and utterly not only embarrass myself, but maybe call into future, have everybody know about my integrity and my you know, you could be thinking to yourself, your idiocy in the market.
Absolutely.
And what are you going to do again? You'd rather not do that, but maybe you could still kick the can and solve the problem if you slip into criminal fraud with this new investor.
Right. And, you know, the thing is, I wouldn't even say then I thought, well, you know, if, you know, now that I've got this $500,000, if I can make it back. It was never if, it's a matter of when I'm going to make it back.
Right. So the good intentions, I use that phrase, but, you know, obviously there's issues to it, but the good intentions were intact. You weren't like a criminal mastermind. You were scared to death and you rationalized, oh, okay, now I'm going to get into criminal fraud.
Right. Absolutely. Where, you know, if I'm, you know, that first week of trading, if I would, excuse my language, if I would have the balls to call my clients up and say, hey, we're down 2.89%, you know, just FYI, I'm giving the heads up when you'll get your statements in a couple of weeks that, you know, that's what it's going to show. So we're going to keep moving forward. If I would have just done that, this probably never would have happened.
So, like, I'm sure you read Market Wizards or Stock Market Wizards, which was out around that time. And I forget which investor it was, but one of the guys, he raised money from a client, and day one, they lost a huge chunk of money. And the first thing they did was call that client, tell the client everything that happened. And the client actually put more money with him because of the honesty, you know, is the flip side.
Right. Yeah. It's a shame that I made that decision, you know? So now we're probably in the beginning of 2006. And I'm basically living off of, probably at that point, maybe taking $10,000 every 2-3 months to live on. I've hired a few quant analysts to come in and rework the models. I hired a trading psychiatrist we did a bunch of phone sessions to work with my psychology of trading. That's really where my bigger issue was. If I would have followed my trading models as I should have, I probably would have been up money. I definitely wouldn't have lost nearly as much as I lost.
Did you use to build your trading models?
So I used a software called TradeStation.
Oh yeah, I know it very well. It has like a C-like language to build the
models.
It's really
easy to build and test. And that was the issue. It's like, I know what I should be doing with this trade, but am I going to try to outguess it and outsmart it? Because I've had, four losers in a row. I'm not going to take the next trade. And, sure enough, that's going to be the winner.
And who is your trading psychologist?
I'm going to go to the end, and we can kind of backtrack a little bit and talk about some of the red flags. So, basically, I'm almost at the 8-year period, and I'm probably down to under $100,000 again. And I could have raised more money. I had probably 3-4 prospects where I could have raised another probably $500,000-$600,000, maybe a little bit more. Now, understand, I'm raising money. Other clients are putting more money in during this period as well, during that from year 3 to year 8. As well. So I'm really hemorrhaging money. So
why are you so consistently losing? Like this mean reversion strategy is just not working.
Well, if I would have followed the system as I should have, I probably would have done not really much worse than having some small losses.
Okay.
Right. And it was just the fact that if I could, kind of come up with, rework it so I could, reduce some of the losers, because like I said, the winner, it was probably winning probably almost 2/3 of the time. Of course, those are small losses, right? Versus the big losses. How do I, can I trade bigger sides in certain situations and maximize those and minimize the 1 or 2 losing trades in a week versus the 20 winning trades during the week?
Yeah.
It gets to the point where, and I'm going to just say again, I never really thought that I couldn't make the money back. And it was early December of 2010, and I'm on my balcony overlooking downtown Chicago. It was a Sunday, holding a cup of coffee. I'm thinking, I'm down about, just about 4 mil. I'm not going to make it back. I'm done. So really within about, 30 seconds, I decided I basically kind of gave all my stuff away. I had a beautiful Hammond organ I donated to a church. I sold my condo and basically had sent that money to some clients who had redemption requests. And I went outside of the city to a firearms dealer, and I was gonna purchase a gun. Of course, they know from the city in that time, you couldn't have a firearm in the city. So the guy wanted to sell me a revolver. Now, I had nothing about guns at all. Nothing. Never held one, never shot one or anything other than what I saw on TV. He goes, "This is all you need. It's 50, 60 bucks, whatever it was." I'm like, I'm looking around. I go, "What about that one over there?" He goes, "Oh, that's a Glock 17. That's going to be about $600. That's way too much gun for it." It's like, "Well, I want to get that one." So I ended up buying that one.
Why did you want the Glock instead of the revolver? Did you think the revolver couldn't do the job?
I don't know if it was ego or what it was. I knew why I was buying it. I was buying it to commit suicide. And I just thought, boy, that Glock looks really cool. That's what I was going to buy. And that's what I did buy. So I bought the Glock. I had to wait a week before I could pick it up. And at that time it was, Christmas time, and spend a lot of time with family, friends, with even some of my in local investors. They had no idea, of course, what was going on. I ended up going to Vegas for New Year's, and I came back literally from the airport, went right to pick up the firearm and basically took it home, wrote a bunch of letters, and, you know, was going to, you know, commit suicide. And I understand that I had never even held a firearm before. Here I am with this Glock 17, and, you know, I've got the clip out, and it's a new clip, and I'm trying to, you know, I'm on YouTube trying to figure out how to, you know, how to load ammunition into this clip. And it was, I mean, comical, I guess, now that I can kind of laugh at it. And on January 4th at about 3 in the morning, I walked from Chicago's Lincoln Park to North Avenue Beach and, you know, got there, said a few prayers. It was pretty cold. And I had, you know, my glove off in my right hand. And I raised the Glock to my forehead and pulled the trigger and nothing happened. I go, how could this happen? I mean, I'm looking for a safety. There's no safety on it. Well, literally, I didn't know it at the time, but the Glock has a built-in safety feature in the trigger. And your finger has to be on the trigger in a certain way. Else the lock will kick in. The lock is actually in the trigger. And that's what saved my life. And basically, you know, walked back to I was staying with my girlfriend at the time, and walked back and you know, contacted an attorney. And, you know, 2 days later, I was sitting in front of the U.S. attorney and the FBI in Chicago.
Oh, my gosh.
And they had no idea who I was. They had no idea. I'd never been under any investigation with any regulatory or state agency. And they're like, you know, they kind of didn't believe it really kind of at first. And my only requirement really was that they, you know, they file a complaint relatively quickly so I could, you know, be incarcerated. So really I could protect myself from myself. And I think it probably took them about 10 days, 12 days, which was actually pretty quick for them. Because, you know, I mean, you know, the FBI is like, well, you know, we've got to check this out. We want to make sure you're not some nut that, you know, that wants to be incarcerated. We need to kind of check and make sure that what you're saying is true. And yeah, so that's what happens. I proffered with them a complaint, gave them all my documents, proffered with the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, and then was incarcerated in January of 2011.
That was a riveting story. Come back tomorrow because James goes to jail. Why? What happened? And what happened after that? It still continues the story. And it's such an interesting topic to me. I mean, I was running a hedge fund around the same time as James, and I knew a lot of funds in that business, and I was skeptical of all of them. And it was fascinating for James to kind of open to my eyes to how much fraud was out there. But we take it even further in tomorrow's continuation, starting with James Goes to Jail. James Brandolini, that is, not me.